I'm Terry Thornton. I'm curator of education here at the Modern, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you to Tuesday evenings. Tonight, we have the pleasure of hearing from Howard Ruchowski as he is in conversation with the Modern's chief curator, Michael Oppie. A Dallas native, Howard earned a BS degree in economics in 1966 from the University of Pennsylvania Wharton School of Business, and later his Juris Doctorate degree in 1970 from the University of Texas at Austin. As a hedge fund manager for 30 years, he started the Regal Group of Companies in the 1970s and acted as the managing partner of Regal Security Investments and president and chairman of the board of Regal Capital Company. Howard also serves as an active member for several boards, such as the Dia Center for the Arts in New York, the Dallas Center for the Performing Arts, the Dallas Symphony Association, and the East Dallas Community School. He is also a member of the Collections and Finance Committees and on the Board of Trustees at the Dallas Museum of Art, and acts as Advisory Director to the Booker T. Washington Arts Magnet School and the University of Texas School of Architecture. In 2000, he married Cindy Dake. Cindy currently serves on the Board of Trustees at the Dallas Museum of Art and has been active in other organizations such as the Design Industries Foundation Fighting AIDS and the March of Dimes. She has co-chaired AMFAR's 2x2 for AIDS and Art Auction for 14 years, which is an annual event that is held at the Ruchowski House and benefits both the Dallas Museum of Art's Contemporary Art Acquisition Fund and the AMFAR, the Foundation for AIDS Research. Together, Cindy and Howard continue to build their collection of post-war and contemporary art that Howard started in the early 1980s. Their collection is displayed in a home designed by Richard Meyer. And in February of 2005, the collection and the house, along with the collections of Marguerite and Robert Hoffman and Dee Dee Rose, were pledged as a testamentary promised gift to the Dallas Museum of Art. In October of 2012, the Ruchowskis, along with Amy and Vernon Faulkner, opened a new exhibition space, The Warehouse, which will show work from both of their collections. The DFW Metroplex has benefited immensely from Howard and Cindy Ruchowski's generosity as they have graciously shared their prized collection through educational programming, events for artists, tours, exhibitions, and other initiatives. And tonight, that generosity has been extended to us as we are given insight into the Ruchowski collection and its development through this special presentation conversation between Howard and Michael. So without further delay, please join me in welcoming Howard Ruchowski and Michael Oppie.
Thank you.
We will all be happy to hear that this is not going to be an art history lecture. We're going to show quite a few slides of art, but it's really about, in my mind, the reasons and logistics of collecting art in this age. And so, Howard, I'm going to get right to it here and go to some very early works that you collected. I think this would be in the early 1980s, maybe late 1970s, and ask you about what you were thinking about when you bought these works. Not to justify them, just what you were thinking about.
Well, I was introduced to art, quite frankly, never educated or took any courses in art history. And really, almost by a degree of serendipity, stumbled into a gallery in the mid to late 70s, a little gallery in Dallas, for those of you who have been around long enough, called Contemporary Gallery in the Quadrangle in Dallas, and began collecting, if we can use that word, prints under the guidance of a man named Ralph Kahn, who was the owner and proprietor of that gallery. And for the most part, he introduced me to an eclectic arrangement of works that really stem from classical modernism. It was really Moreau's and Picasso's and Chagall's and Calder. Prints, large editions, not a lot of money because I didn't have the resources to collect at length. But over time, he introduced me to more and more of the work that was going on in the contemporary universe. And so he was sort of the, if I can say, the first guide influence to me in terms of beginning to collect. The works that you've begun to show here really were from a few years later. I'd had some experience with him over the course of time, again, by more random than this cosmic plan, met two dealers in New York, one lady named Ann Friedman, who was a dealer at and director at Knoedler Gallery, and the other a man named Nathan Kolodner, who was a director at Emmerich Gallery. So my initial impulse, at least in terms of collecting more significant work, really was inspired by this sort of melange of folks. And the works that you've shown are works that were all bought at that point in time.
Many of these works are such a far cry from what you collect now that it makes me ask, what was your definition of art at that time? I mean, we all start with something, and then we end with something else.
Well, it was a comfort level. It was trying to buy work that seemed like it was significant, that I had read about in the books, which I had started to explore, and it worked. And it was work that was comfortable and had great visual accessibility, if you will. I could understand it. I would buy a work, or I would think about buying a work. I'd get whatever books I could find about that artist. I'd read the narratives. I would sort of fall in love with the mythology surrounding those artists, and that really was the impulse.
I mean, that's an honest answer. I've talked to a lot of collectors, and you know a real collector when they're honest and they say, well, you know, it was really about visual accessibility. It's what I could get at that time. The collector you don't want to believe is says, well, you know, I used to draw as a child. And you immediately go, no. Now, you told me that this was... I ask you by email, you know, what one of your first big purchases was. And this was one of them, I think, wasn't it?
Correct.
Paul Jenkins.
Correct.
Who you probably wouldn't buy a Paul Jenkins painting today, but it was a big deal then.
Well, I might, but for a different reason,
okay.
Which we can go into okay. later. But nonetheless, it's probably true.
So, and how much, it was a big purchase for you. Do you mind if I ask how much you paid? At that time, this would be 82.
This would have been probably a little earlier, probably 1980. It would have been,
1980.
I paid $22,000
for one.
For one,
but you bought two, and I think you paid like 40.
I paid 40 for the both. Yeah, and I visited him in his studio,
right.
And he had participated in a film called An Unmarried Woman, where his image was in there actually painting one of these paintings. And I remember having seen the movie, but that's the extent of my connection. But I'd gone with Ralph Kahn to New York on a art buying excursion.
I probably would have bought it too.
And
with all of that information. With all of that information.
And of course, to carry it to the further extreme, I had a perfect wall for this very, very large work. And so it was, you know, it hung over at this place in my house on Forest Creek in Dallas for 10 years.
I think I went to that house.
You probably
when
did.
When I first came here, I would have been here 20 years. This would have been about 17 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Was that
could have been
Forest?
Yeah, I guess if I'd go back, pretty close, yes.
And this is a Frank Stella Protractor painting that you bought. More rigorous.
A bit more rigorous, but again, about the same time frame. This was actually in 82. I had actually seen this painting almost 2 years before at Knoedler Gallery, and I bought this painting through Ralph and Ann Friedman. in 1982, but that was, interestingly enough, during a moment when one actually thought about purchasing art, and it wasn't an impulse decision that you made in 15 seconds because a dealer was holding a gun to your head saying, if you don't buy it, Joe will. So give me an answer quickly. You can think about it, but you have 15 seconds to come back with an answer. This was a case of a piece I had seen on that Paul Jenkins excursion, as a matter of fact, and it had stayed with me as a visual experience. But then, of course, I've read about Frank Stella, and he sort of fit in a sense of the of non-objective work that intrigued me. So I think that clearly I was drawn to this visually as well.
And the other thing that I think certain generation will not understand, older people like myself will, because we've been through it, is that there would be a point here where Howard Roshofsky could walk into a gallery and you wouldn't even get a second look from the gallery attendant.
No, I'd be ignored,
you might,
in fact.
Say, you would be ignored. You might say, how much is that? And they might ignore you. In other words, there was a point...
And I had such an example, actually, which is maybe somewhat relevant, is that a gallery with whom I've ultimately done very significant work, the Pace Gallery. Mm-hmm. I walked in, and they were doing an exhibition. And this was during the 80s. And, you know, the gallerina chewing gum at the front desk, who was clearly the offspring of a big big client, wouldn't even tell me what the works cost and any information whatsoever. It happened to be a Lichtenstein show. Maybe that's why I never collected pop art, is that ran me off. That, and I literally didn't walk back in Pace Gallery for well over a decade, which was my misfortune and theirs as well.
Well, you weren't on the A list. You were on the D,
yeah.
C list. And so welcome to the museum world today. So what is it? What did it take to get on the A list? What did it take for them to go, you know, when they look at their cameras, go, Howard Roshofsky's in the gallery, and they do have cameras. They do have cameras in these galleries.
I think, sadly, occasionally it's because you're truly engaged and you get in a conversation with a dealer who also is not just in it to transact but to teach. And that does, in fact, happen and did, in fact, happen. But I think at the end of the day, the reality is that they pay rent and have to feed families and they have to keep doors open, and money talks. And if you transact and you start buying works from galleries over time, they begin to invite you to exhibitions, they invite you to dinners, they sometimes, if they really like you and you haven't gotten to the very top of the list, but you're in the top 10, they will call you and say, well, we've got an exhibition of X. Would you be, here's some images. Would you be interested in knowing more?
And then not in 1994, but obviously this is the Roshofsky House. Hopefully many of you have been there. Howard and Cindy have opened up their house to the community in a way that very few collectors do. If you haven't, this is a view from the road of their house. It's designed by Richard Meyer. You started thinking about it, I would guess, in 92. It opened in 94. Right.
Well, not actually 96, but I actually met Richard in the early 80s, in 1983. Mm-hmm. The saga was much longer, and I had gone to Atlanta and saw the museum. The High Museum had just opened, and
this is the High Museum in Atlanta.
There it is, and it was just such a day, clear, crisp fall day, and I fell in love with the experience of being and the light quality and being in and around that, and so I actually contacted Richard about the possibility of doing a residence. I actually didn't even know that he did houses at the time. He had actually done a half a dozen or so, but I was unaware of that when I made the call. And again, one of those sets of circumstances between the time I saw the museum in Atlanta and the time I was arranging to see Richard, which was around the Thanksgiving holiday time, he won a little commission in Los Angeles called the Getty.
Called the Getty.
And so, the largest private commission in history, at least in terms of money at the time. And So, but nonetheless, he met with me, and he actually was incredibly gracious. He said, "I actually do homes, and I actually enjoy doing them. I've never done anything in that part of in Texas or anywhere within 1,000 miles, actually, of Texas. But for me, houses are like laboratories. I work with one client. We kind of play with ideas. Some work, some don't. And you know, at the end of the day, they really are relevant to my practice." So he said, "If you're not in a big hurry," and I wasn't, "let's talk about a program and see what happens."
So when you, I mean, you approached him right after he got, right before he got the Getty Commission, apparently. Or, I mean, I want to get this straight, because the Getty Museum is 1.2 million square feet of gallery space. It's 16 tons of travertine shipped from Italy. And so Howard asked him to build him his house. I'm sure he's wondering, you know, so on what scale do you want to work here? I mean, it must have been a little intimidating, and I want to ask what your relationship with him was in building the house, because, you know, our experience is with great architects is once you decide to make the commission, they become incredibly hard of hearing. It's a medical thing that happens, and they go on to design what they want to design, and you have to yell really, really loud.
Well, in the case of Richard, quite frankly, he had an infrastructure, and part of that infrastructure is delegation of responsibilities for project architects. And at the time, he introduced me to a young man named Tom Pfeiffer, who became the project architect on the Rachofsky House. And so this was a significant project for Tom in Richard's office, and we developed a very close and personal relationship. So if Richard would come to the site, Don Cox, who was the junior architect on the project, would literally be in Dallas every 2 weeks. All of this was done out of New York. Tom would come about every 6 weeks. Richard would come every 6 months. So there was clearly a hierarchy. But Richard did take a great and serious interest in this, and was very much supportive of the process. Again, it wasn't a huge time commitment, but it was a chance to explore some ideas that he had, and to create a piece of architecture that was significant, albeit in a more modest scale.
Did you, I guess two questions. One is, were you building a home, or were you building a house that would house art, in the beginning at least? And was there an evolution to that?
Well, I think, again, without boring everyone to tears, this house is called Rachofsky House 2. Rachofsky House 1 was designed or was conceived of being a more family-oriented building. It had 4 bedrooms, and it looked like this, but it served a function of a house and not as a gallery with a residence in it. So it was much more domestic, at least in terms of its concept. When I got the bids on that, it was so outrageous that I couldn't afford it, and it was not to be. I really, abandoned the idea, came back to Richard 5 years later with what, in fact, is what was ultimately built, which is more, I would characterize it as an apartment over a gallery. And so that really is what was produced, and that is what the Rachofsky House is.
It's a gorgeous house. It's
a daytime house. It looks really cool.
It's beautiful in the daytime. Nice. The sense of transparency. It's a gorgeous house. It's surprising for as a collector, it doesn't have a lot of wall space. And
no, because architects are very good at sabotaging.
Exactly. And, Richard Meyer has had his problems with artists. I mean, he and Robert Irwin went at it big time at the Getty, and it's hard to say who won. I mean, I can argue it from both sides, actually. Bob Irwin is a great, great artist, but You know, he's as architectural as an architect. So it made it difficult, but not impossible, for you to show works that you were collecting at that time. It almost seems like the house helped you focus the collection, and the sort of the next stage of focus was minimalism. If you had a minimalist architect like Meyer, maybe minimalism was the thing.
Absolutely, and I think that ultimately was the impulse. Maybe not consciously in the most overt way, but clearly under the consciousness was this notion that this is the aesthetic that I had, and this is what was in many ways driving my thinking. And you know, the house was finished in '96, and essentially this sort of. There's sort of the collection, or what would one call a collection before the house, and then the collection after the house. The house became a catalyst for right. rethinking of what a collection should be. Again, you have to backtrack a little bit again, because in all candor, when I collected, I would characterize it the first 15 or 16 years was really not about this voracious appetite or affliction that causes one to buy more than they should. It was really a more labored, studious thought process that you'd buy a work and then you'd buy another work. I think the collection probably had 60 or 70 works in it as late as probably 1988-89, which was almost mm-hmm. a dozen years after starting to collect. There was a lot of work, but it wasn't as overwhelming as what transpired from, say, the early mid-90s forward.
This is a great shot of a Donald Judd, which is so beautiful in that house, because it's like it's a Judd outside of a Judd. I mean, there's this transparency going through the sculpture. It's just really beautiful.
There's Mr. Irwin.
And this was a pretty big commission, a Robert Irwin. Can you just talk a little bit about this one, how it came about, why it looks the way it does? Some people might not recognize it as a Bob Irwin, but it has all of the subtleties and sort of perceptual shifts of one.
Well, the challenge was, and this is by which time I had started working with Alan Schwartzman, who became an advisor to the collection. And the challenge was, how do you put an object in front of a building that in and of itself is a piece of sculpture? Right. It becomes a real challenge. Do you do something monumental to speak to it, or do you do something more subtle? And we interviewed four or five artists of some renown. And then at a lunch one day, Arnie Glimcher at Pace Gallery, someone about whom you and I spoke earlier.
Not them.
Them, believe it or not, was having lunch at the house, and he happened to represent Bob Irwin, and said to Alan and I, as we were sitting at lunch, he said, you know, we were wrestling with this idea, who or what should we put in the landscape? And he said, well, Bob Irwin conceived of this project in the mid-70s for Ohio State University. And when he presented the project, or the idea of the project, to the Board of Regents or Trustees, they said, that's very interesting, but where's the art? And so it was unrealized. Bob had literally submitted dozens of projects and had never been able to realize these commissioned ideas because people didn't get it. At any rate, we invited Bob to come down, and Bob came with a myth and a legend. Mm-hmm. And he only drank fountain Cokes, and so we had to go try to find a fountain Coke, and we went through it. I mean we bowed and scraped, and he said, y'all just leave me alone, let me think about this. So again, making a long story shorter, he conceived of doing this work called Tilted Planes, which essentially plays off the grid of Richard's building, but by tweaking the grid in the landscape, gave composition and form and an interesting idea to it. In fact, it is one of my favorite works in the collection. And what's equally interesting, it was done on time, on budget, with a handshake.
Wow.
which is, and I can assure you that's the only one that ever happened that way.
Well, it is very beautiful. And, I mean, it works just as you say. It's non-monumental. It doesn't interfere with the architecture, and yet it plays with it, and it's great.
But it is a piece that keeps on giving and keeps on charging, because the people that have to come clip the grass around the edges twice a week. I do have a penchant for high maintenance work.
Yes, you do. Yes, you do. And speaking of an art consultant, what you hired Alan Schwartzman, I guess sometime around
97.
Okay. What compelled you to hire an art consultant? I mean, most collectors, I think, have, like all of us, we have egos. We want to think it's our idea. What if you hire a consultant, are they going to be in control? Are they building the collection, or are you building the collection? How did that develop?
Well, I was introduced to Alan through a lady named Andrea Schwann. Andrea was Richard Meyer's public relations, architectural public relations
And Frank Gehry's
and extraordinarily good. And she had seen the collection, and it was clearly, let's say, it was eclectic. It really didn't have a specific direction. Alan at the time was spent most of his time writing. Over his career earlier, he had been a writer, he had been a gallerist, he had been a critic. But he had never, the whole idea of what an art consultant wasn't such was a bit of a novel idea back in 96 or 97. And so she introduced me to him, and we agreed to work together on a consulting basis to help, quote unquote, shape and form a collection in a spirit of what I really wanted to achieve. And it's been a fascinating and wonderful collaboration, and I give him significant credit for the evolution of the collection, and I think the significance of it, because it doesn't look like every other collection. No. And I think he's grown into being, as it turns out, I was his first client, and he's turned out to be one of the most successful art advisors in the world right now.
Well, you guys have done great things together, I have to say, and in all sincerity. And it's just like with architecture, you know, you can't get a great building with a stupid client. It doesn't happen, I assure you. And so you have to be a smart client and be able to give of yourself and let other people inform you. And one of the brilliant things that Howard and Allen did was they started to think about neglected areas in art history. And one of those is arte povera. So this is post-war Italian art. And post-war Italian art, arte povera meaning poor art. It's art that looks poor, although it's done by fine artists. So some people compare it to process art in the United States, but it really predates that, and it competed with abstract expressionism. So it was hard for arte povera to become an important movement during the ascendance of abstract expressionism. But there were some incredibly great things made, and they were undervalued.
Absolutely. Again, you do what you have to do. If you have all the resources in the world, I guess you can go buy a Rothko or a Pollock. But if you don't, you have to try to be a touch ingenious if you really want to form a collection that has a bit of an identity. And we, in a way, stumbled on this material, but we love the way it resonated with minimalism, really. We didn't think of it in so much in terms of its relationship to ABX, but more to its relationship to the American descendant of that, if you will, of non-objective art, of this minimalist aesthetic.
And these are really beautiful things. I've been the beneficiary of Howard and Cindy's generosity in lending this work, and actually this work, to an exhibition I did called Declaring Space. And this particular work by Lucio Fontana, you bought at auction in London.
Correct.
Is that isn't the first work you purchased at auction, was it?
No. No, I had bought works at
auction. Was it a little nerve-wracking? You probably paid a little more for this one?
Yes. It was extremely nerve-wracking. It was to some degree fascinating. I always used a dealer to represent me at auction as opposed to bidding myself, but we would have pre-existing plans. And the gallerist that I always used is a fellow that you know well, Tony Meyer.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were in London and having dinner and planning strategy. We saw the work. We really wanted to try to acquire this. So I gave him some price parameters. But we were literally flying back from London to Dallas that day. So we had no idea that we actually had prevailed. I didn't know whether to be excited or faint because we spent a fortune for it. And luckily, Tony bid one more bid higher than I would have bid had I been there to do it. So thankfully, because of that, we were able to acquire this work. And again, this is probably the singular most important work in the collection.
Mm-hmm. It's a great piece. And it is a fascinating process, buying at auction. Museums don't do it very often because you have to get the approval of your board. And usually if you get the approval of your board, it's for a given price. Although they might say you can bid up to X. But then again, you know, you can bid up to X and miss it by $10,000. But museums can't do that and private collectors can. And that's why we hate you. I mean, not a lot, but as you said before, you know, there comes a point in your collecting where it isn't just about buying pictures and hanging them on the wall. It becomes this installation process. It becomes almost like a museum. And there must have been a point where you had to develop a budget just for installation. For something like this.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, how much does that... Was that weigh a ton and a half, that stone?
Just about.
Yeah.
In fact, we had to reinforce the ceiling so that it would... There's a little steel plate in there, additional steel plate.
Yeah.
But the good news is Mr. Meyer's building is got more steel in it than most high-rises, so it can withstand pretty much anything.
I mean, the rooms in the house they really become almost like museum rooms. They're really beautiful, and, it seems to me that it was inevitable that at some point you and Cindy would move out. that the art was... It's not a place where I'm going to eat macaroni and cheese in my pajamas, you know, and watch TV. It is the space became very formal, very beautiful, and not...
Well, it became too public. I mean, at the end of the day, you know,
right.
when the house was built, the notion was that, you know, you'd have a few parties, you'd raise some money for some nonprofits, and people would wish you well and bring you a bottle of champagne, and then year two, they'd forget all about you, and no one would call. The problem is in year two, three, to infinity, the numbers that wanted to come kept growing. You know, the house is situated on a very public road, Preston Road in Dallas, and so it's really a state highway, and it's one block from a big shopping center, so it's in a highly visible area, and people watch this crazy building going up for 4 or 5 years, and so by the time it was finished and this white thing is sitting there, you know, people are curious at the very least and want to see it, and so and then you go in and there's a collection to see as well. It's not bad. So the answer is yes. It becomes, it no longer allows for the kind of intimate experience that you have in a residence when you, as I say, want to have your mac and cheese and wear your pajamas.
But you're very modest about it. I mean, I've known a lot of collectors over my 40 years of being a curator, and many collectors are very generous, but I can't think of many that are more generous than you and Cindy in allowing the public in. If I go and visit You know, I like to think I'm an important curator. I've made a special appointment to have lunch with Howard. I'm going to have the place to myself. School buses are lined outside as I pull up, and I think that it makes me feel good. It gives me a sense that these are people that are sharing their knowledge and their collection with people.
You have to really blame that on Thomas Fulmer, whom I stole from Fort Worth, actually.
And you began, there was the collection on Arte Povera, the concentration on Arte Povera, and then things got more psychological, pieces like this, Louis Bourgeois, Georg Baselitz. And so there's this psychological aspect to the collection, and I'm wondering if that's something that was sort of thought out on you and Alan's part, or whether or not that's just the way the art world was moving.
I think there was a conscious thought. A lot of the work that we were, the more figurative representational work that was interesting to us, had a dark side to it, had a very psychological side. That work seemed to be more interesting than the happy-go-lucky figurative works. And for the most part, the collection, you know, that has figurative elements to it is imbued with deep psychological meaning. And that seems to resonate for me particularly.
Right. And as you pointed out earlier, that you know, you occasionally wander into these works that require extreme maintenance. This is this piece by Mark Quinn that is made of human blood, and so it has to be refrigerated, right?
Correct.
So again, that's probably another reason for moving out of the house. I don't know how Cindy feels about that, but you know, you get up to get a glass of water, and this. This head made of human blood is there.
It's actually pretty beautiful.
It's very beautiful. It's a very beautiful piece. I've seen it installed a number of times. So does it stay in this refrigerated container all the time when it's not on display?
No, it actually lives in a freezer.
Does it really?
Down in the basement, yeah.
There's a big freezer down there.
Exactly. You know, where you keep your deer meat, you know how?
Yeah. Wow, yeah.
it's actually on loan to a museum in Denmark right now.
And then another thing that you guys figured out was another area, neglected area of art history, actually very similar to Arte Povera, which is post-war Japanese art, particularly just after the war, between, say, 1945, 1965, 1970. An area that people hadn't thought about because abstract expressionism was so powerful. But Gutai was a very powerful movement, and it's something you've focused on.
In the last couple of years, this really has been the center of our attention. I think that it's going to have more and more presence as major institutions do exhibitions. There's about to be, in February, they'll be opening at the Guggenheim, the first significant exhibition since the early 90s. And I think the work is very compelling. If for those who enjoy painting, particularly the Gutai material is very much about the materiality and the process of making work. It's almost as if the process is important as the ultimate imagery and object, and it's really quite elegant. And of course, it's new information for a Western audience.
And this is one of the famous guys. Is it Monoha?
Yes.
Movement, and I mean, this is a guy who's very, very well known, and this is one of his most famous pieces. So this is a displacement of the earth brought up, right? I mean, it's
correct.
Literally like a core sample.
Exactly.
Of the earth.
Again, very much in balance, using basic materials to create an aesthetic. I think, and it particularly to me resonates with the Irwin in the landscape, and it has a great relationship to it. It's cited in relation to it, and I think resonates quite wonderfully. And again, these works were made to when they were first made. For the most part, many of them were destroyed because they were put up almost as temporary exhibitions, and they existed in for a moment. And then it's only really been in the last couple of years that they've almost been permitted to have a career outside of Japan.
And they're really just being remade in a way, because they were performances as much as
in many cases. Yeah. There was as much about the aspect of performance as it was about the object.
And I wanted to talk now briefly about some younger artists, and by that I mean 30s and 40s, that you've been interested in. And this is an artist named Mark Grosjean.
Right.
And you've collected quite a few of his works, and he's become a very, very prominent artist. And it kind of begs the question, when you're buying really contemporary art like this, you know, the nature of how the art market has changed since when you were first collecting in the late 70s. Mark is someone who sells privately now for a painting $2 million.
Some do, yes.
Some do. I mean, maybe rare, but, you know, and we're talking about a painting that may be 4 feet by 6 feet. $2 million. And he is a very good abstract painter, someone who's interested me a lot. You know, it fascinates me because if I think about it just from an inflationary standpoint, I mean, Rothko never sold a painting for $1 million in his entire life. Probably the highest price, and someone could Google this and let us know, but please don't. You know, I bet Rothko probably in his lifetime, the highest work was sold for $300,000. Even by inflationary standards, that wouldn't be what Mark Grosjean is selling for now.
Of course, a Rothko now is 60 or 70.
It's 60 million. Or 70 million. Yeah. But I was trying to
whatever
Google
that
with an inflation calculator, and it still doesn't quite pan out. You know, to that, even by the, you know, the dealers deal with the square inch syndrome. You take it, you know, if it's 4 by 5 feet, and a Rothko is 8 by 9 feet by square inch, and I'm not trying to say anything negative about Grosjean, because I happen to like his art a lot, but it really does put pressure on the collector, whether you're a museum or a private collector, to say, wow, really? I mean, how do you feel about that when you... I mean, you were smart. You bought Grosjean when he was $75,000.
True.
In my recollection.
True.
Which I thought was a lot. but now, you know, he's up there and, you know, it's a leap of faith, isn't it?
Well, it is clearly a leap of faith. And again, speaking to your observation before of access, he happens to be represented by at least two of the three primary dealers that represent him are people that I'm close to, that I've had long-standing relationships with, and that Alan has had long-standing relationships with. And we started buying the work in 2002, and because he was someone that was interesting to us, we've bought works on paper, we've bought small paintings, we've bought a work like this, of which there are only two, are very eccentric examples. These flower paintings of his are example, and this is the most recent purchase. Right. And this one I paid it was a case of having access and a choice, but paid a very significant sum for this work that would give one pause. But I happen to think he's one of the most interesting painters working today, and may or may not, you know, stand the test of time 2 decades from now, but at least at the moment, at least it feels to me like he's making good work, and he continues to explore and push the envelope, and is making good things.
I mean, he, along with another artist you have purchased, Wade Guyton, who has a retrospective. Well, I wouldn't call it a retrospective, but it's a kind of a survey up at the up at the Whitney right now, and is getting really great reviews. And he's selling his works for very, very large sums right now. There, you know,
but he's actually not, interestingly enough, at the primary market at the gallerists, and with his permission and with his understanding, he's kept his prices substantially below the resale market. Part of the reason of this, the resale market has gotten so frothy, is there's not a lot of product on the market. They've placed the work very well at the gallery, and they've placed it at probably prices no more than 10 or 15% of the of this so-called bubble price of things. So he really, at least heretofore, has tried to place work institutionally and to not just be market exploitive, but that's a rare artist.
It's still, we're still talking $300,000 to $500,000.
Not on primary market.
For a substantially sized work, I think. And that's a lot of money.
Yes.
And he makes a lot of work. So that's the other aspect to it. These are the things that I say this not to be critical of these artists, but to say the kind of field of operation that Howard has to operate in these situations. Now, he operates differently than I do. I'm spending other people's money. So I have to be a little more careful. Howard can put on the goggles and fly into the sun, and if he explodes, it's his money and it's his daring, and he does it. I can't afford to do that. You know, in the old days, there was a saying in the museum world: always buy 10 years behind the avant-garde. And the reason for that was, never buy something when it's hot. Buy it when it cools down. And if it's a good artist, after they cool down, you'll get a good artist at a good price. Can't do that anymore, can you?
I don't think so.
Yeah. You would know. I mean, you can't. I don't think you can. There's just the thing is moving so quickly forward, and the art market has broadened, the art market has broadened its base to such an extent that you know, that you really have to get it now or you don't get it.
Well, again, that's the reason that I suggest, if someone comes to me and say, I want to collect, what should I do? And I would say, go back and look at history. And there's a lot of work made post, and the only thing I can speak to is post-war. Mm-hmm. I can't really speak to earlier material. But go back and look at works that are not on the hot button list. That's sort of what led us to the Italian material, and it's what has led us to the Japanese material. It's really compelling work, and you don't have to fight 40 really rich people to buy it. You've got to be engaged in it, and you've got to become curatorially interested and do some reading and studying and looking. That's sort of the old-fashioned way of collecting, and it's sort of fun.
It is, and you have to forget about being hip. And when you work with other people's money, you definitely have to forget about being hip. You would love to be hip, and you would love to have everybody love you. But what you really got to do is do the right thing, which, you know, and that brings me to my favorite topic, which is art fairs, you know, which is a phenomenon of the last, how long has it been? 10 years?
10, 15. 10, certainly 15 in the last years. 10, it's exploded. There's one everywhere.
Well, there is one everywhere.
One in Dallas,
and you, well, and the thing of it is, and you go to all of them.
No.
And you know I hate them. I hate them with a passion. And the art fair, perhaps you could explain, because you really know the ins and outs of art fairs better than I do. What is the value of an art fair, and why do you think it has developed?
It's a great place to meet and greet.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not a good place to buy. in my view, although I have bought at fairs, you know, and oftentimes dealers, again, that industry is evolving, so dealers literally bring material that they've pre-sold to there for a client from Brazil or from Paris or from Dallas or Fort Worth come in to... you know, to basically say, yes, I love it, I'll buy it. But for me, the art fair serves two purposes. Number one, it's a chance to say hello to a lot of people in one place without having to fly around the world. And two, for dealers that who live in places that I don't get to very often, Berlin, Cologne, Milan, Rome, even London, it's a chance to spend a few minutes with people that you've gotten to know over time, and the next time you're in their city, you go to the gallery, you carry on or continue a conversation that you may have started about an artist who is new to your experience, about which you'd like to know more. I think they can serve a very Reader's Digest kind of editing place in the collecting milieu, if you will. Does it replace going to galleries and seeing exhibitions and or going to museums and seeing exhibitions? Absolutely not, because you don't see art at an art fair.
Well, it is fascinating. You know, I would argue that an art fair is more about entertainment than it is about contemplation. And it certainly, you know, there's a lot of entertainment value at art fairs, particularly Miami Basel.
A lot of late dinners. A
lot of late dinners, the drums are pounding late at night, and it is great entertainment. And you say, well, it's not a great place to buy, and I would agree with you completely. But then the dealers tell me, and I believe them, that 65 to 75% of their sales are done at art fairs.
But to a different type of collector. There's collectors in the world today. The way the industry is changing, who would... my wife buys stuff online all the time. I can't even fathom how you, without going up and touching this, why can't I, you know?
Right.
But she does it comfortably. Yesterday was Black Monday or Blue Monday or whatever they call it. You know, black and blue, and they sold billions
of
dollars change hands during the season. There's a new way of selling, and the way that it is people literally fly in to these various art fairs and go shopping. And I don't think that we think that is necessarily collecting, but they're new folks, and that's the way they choose to buy art.
It is a funny thing, and I've thought about this a lot. There's a cheapness to an art fair that actually works. I mean, in my day early on, the whole idea was you walked into Leo Castelli Gallery and it was like, my God, I'm in Leo Castelli Gallery and there's a gallerina there. As you said, I'll never get back to the back. They'll never let me back there because it's so special. Well, at an art fair, strip all the architecture away and they're shopkeepers. That's what they are. And you go, wow. That's what it is. You've got objects, you're selling them, and you're in a booth. it has to do with, and there's a good thing about that, because there are people who are intimidated by going in to a gallery.
Sure.
Right? And going into Leo Castelli Gallery or Barbara Gladstone Gallery or Marion Goodman Gallery, because they're not going to get to see, they're not going to get any help.
Well, it's a different language, Michael.
Right.
If you think about it, you know, if you're an art historian, you have all the experience.
Right.
You know, if I sent you to, you know, a diamond, you know, jeweler, you probably are not going to know a sapphire of this quality from another. You need some guidance.
Right.
The whole gallery system is predicated on keeping you a little step removed from really understanding this, and it's until you have to invest the time, the energy, or or be brokered in a sense, right, by walking in with a curator or with another collector or with an advisor, or you get to be part of the club. There is some certain mystique about this that's incredibly off-putting, and particularly if you imagine that you're a very successful businessman, right, in New York. You're not used to people not bowing down when you walk in the room, and you're also not used to not knowing everything about everything, you know. Mm-hmm. And so you walk into this place, and you don't want to show that, you know, you don't know Rothko from Franz Klein.
Right.
So the only way you can do that is you go in with your team or your staff or whatever, and so you're sort of buffered from having to know much about this particular topic, if you will. In a sense, the art fair does equalize that. You can kind of go in and you can look and you can kind of shop around a little bit without the